Hi, this is Eric Elnes, and I am with this afternoon a very distinguished guest, Dr. Joan Roughgarden, who is an evolutionary biologist and professor of biological sciences at Stanford University, and is also a Christian. And Joan has written a book recently that you may be interested in called Evolution and Christian Faith, published by Island Press. Came out right about the same time that the Walkers were arriving in Washington, D.C. in September. And Joan has some very interesting thoughts to share regarding this whole debate between creation and evolution and now intelligent design. And Joan, welcome to the Crosswalk America podcast.
Oh, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Joan, you mentioned in your book that there is an illusion of conflict between belief in God and evolution that's caused by a poor presentation to the public of what evolutionary biology actually is. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think that's true. I think some of the controversy that we keep hearing concerning evolution and Christianity is the fault of biologists for not explaining what evolution is in terms which are helpful to people. It's usually kind of techie and presented in terms which are intimidating and sort of act as a wall between people and what's really going on. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was because when I did attend church and would talk about this with my friends and other parishioners, there would be like a suspicion that there shouldn't be a fight because a lot of my friends were actually working in science or working in biology and they didn't feel conflicted and they didn't know why someone else might feel conflicted. And yet no one could say off the top of their head, on the tip of their tongue, what is evolution? Just what is it, you know? And that's why I wrote this book, is just for the people I knew and for my friends, so that we could have a succinct, simple statement of what evolution is, and you could decide for yourself whether or not there was any problem.
So what is evolution?
The way I broke it down is that there are two main facts of evolution, and then there's also a theory of evolution, which is the explanation for those facts. And the two main facts are, first, that all of life is related to one another. So if you hug a redwood tree, you're hugging a distant relative, not a brother or sister, but a relative nonetheless. And we're related to worms and starfish and bugs and mosquitoes and plants and animals and everything. And that means we all share genes in common. And I'm hoping someday, sort of a fantasy that I have, is that someday in high school there'll be like a little chemistry set which every student could use, and they could just go out and pick up some little animal from nature and then put it in like a little funnel and find out what the genes are in that animal and then do that with a little piece, let's say, of their saliva or some little piece that comes from them and find out what their own genes are and then see how many genes there are in common between each person and every other living thing. So we all belong to one gigantic tree of life. That's the main finding from evolutionary biology, which is that we all share as members of this gigantic tree of life. And the second main fact is that biological species are not static in time or in space. And that's a big deal because that's the difference between physical or non-living species like the elements, like hydrogen and oxygen and so on, or even compounds like water. See, water never changes. It's not as though water is any different now than it was 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. It always froze at 32 degrees and boiled at, you know, 100 degrees centigrade. But a biological species is another matter. So like a robin or a blue jay has changed over time. And this is what Darwin picked up on initially when he was traveling in the Galapagos Islands on his voyage of the Beagle, was that it looked as though the birds he was studying, the finches and turtles and other sorts of things, had all changed a little bit from what they looked like when they were in South America where he first saw them. And it started to dawn on him that species weren't constant in time. Biological species aren't constant in time, but physical species are. Species change, and we all belong to a gigantic tree of life.
One of the criticisms I hear from creationists is that evolutionary theory just simply makes all of life a random process, that it's all random, and therefore there is no meaning or purpose or intention behind it. Do you agree with that statement?
Oh, well, evolutionary biology definitely does not say that life is random and that evolution is random. It absolutely just doesn't say that, and there's no textbook anywhere that says that. And that's the other part of evolutionary biology is, after you kind of wrap your tongue around the two main facts, then the question is, what explains the gigantic tree of life and what explains the fact that animals and plant species change through time? And so the two main pillars of the theory of evolution, as distinct from the facts, are that the animals that do most of the breeding wind up predominating in the subsequent generations of the species. So it's pretty obvious that if the cattle that are speckled, for example, do most of the breeding and the cattle that aren't speckled don't do much breeding, then after several generations, your cattle are all going to be speckled. And that simple point is what was called natural selection by Darwin. And in my book, I've renamed it natural breeding, just that we don't get all hung up on the natural selection word. But that's also in the Bible. And these ideas of evolutionary biology are agrarian in nature and must go back to the dawn of agriculture, and so they turn up in the Bible too. And this notion of natural breeding, where the population comes to resemble those who do most of the breeding, is in the story of Jacob and Laban in the Old Testament in Genesis, where God actually guides the evolution of the stock so that it comes to be mostly speckled cattle, in fact, and they're the ones that Jacob will then own. And this was in recompense for the injustice that Laban carried out against Jacob. So we see in the Bible God's hand directing the course of evolution. And the randomness comes in an entirely different matter. It has to do with whether or not there's any difference among the cattle to begin with. You might want to say, where did the first speckled cow come from? And where did the first speckled bull come from? And that's the part where randomness comes in, where the first appearance of the color just sort of pops up out of the blue. But then the hand of God is what guides the subsequent evolution of the stock. By God's hand is causing, as it were, the speckled cattle to do most of the breeding. Now, the notion of randomness, when of the sort that biologists have, is also in the Bible, and it's in that interesting parable where Jesus talks about mustard seeds, and he's talking about his own teachings and how he sends his teachings out to the multitude, and he draws the analogy to a farmer who's going along on a path, and then mustard seeds spill out of the back of the wagon. And then as some mustard seeds land on good ground and some on shallow ground, and it's the seeds that land on good ground that grow and produce fruit a thousand times over. And I think of a mutation in biology as the same sort of thing. It's a mustard seed of DNA, so to speak, a mustard seed of genes. And these pop up at random in different bodies, and then once they arise, then in some of the bodies, they agree with the other genes that are there and with the rest of the body. And so the body then makes fruit, bears forth fruit. And so it's in this way that you get the randomness just pertaining to the initial appearance, the initial arising of a couple instances of the variation among the individuals. But once it's there, then the hand of God would take over and guide the course of evolution.
And when you say the hand of God would take over to guide it, fill that in a little bit. How do you conceive of God's role in evolution?
I personally see God's hand mostly in guiding the choice, as it were, of who breeds and who doesn't breed. And in that way, God's design, so to speak, unfolds in the fullness of time. And you have an evolving universe as God's plan unfolds. And now God could also control which mutation arises as well. I mean, I don't want to rule that out. It's just there's no particular support for that view. On the other hand, there's been a lot of discussion in evolutionary biology about the direction of evolution. And there's no doubt that the net effect of evolutionary change is to make the species better off than it was when it started out. And you can just imagine an empty island someplace and you introduce some animals there. Like, suppose you introduce rabbits to an empty island. And initially, the rabbits don't know how to find food and don't particularly know how to find shelter and maybe how to avoid predators. But then occasionally a mutation will turn up and there'll be one individual who knows how to find food, or there'll be another one who knows how to identify the warning signs for a predator. And then you find that their descendants will slowly but surely come to predominate in the population. And that's the direction of evolution. It's to the, within any species, it's to improve the capability of the species in the environment that it's residing in. And this is the hand of God, setting a direction of evolutionary progress. And as I say, that's the case discussed in such explicit detail in the Laban-Jacob story. And you could lift the Laban-Jacob account of change, of evolutionary change in the stock of cattle and sheep and so on, and just plug it verbatim into an evolution book today, and it would fit. And it's just remarkable. And I think one of the main values of the little book that I've just done is to tell what evolution is in terms that are inherently friendly to a Christian tradition, because it draws on metaphors that are also metaphors found in the Bible.
On that, you mentioned that St. Paul has some helpful words with respect to our understanding of the relationship between our faith and evolution. What does Paul have to say that you find helpful?
What I find so stimulating is St. Paul's whole notion of a Christian community as being members of one body, and it's some of the most progressive passages actually in the Bible concerning inclusion. And he talks about how no one person can be kicked out of the community just the way no part of the body can be amputated, like you can't cut off the arm or the leg or something without the rest of the body suffering. And it's a beautiful notion. And what evolutionary biologists have found out is that since we're all members of a common tree of life, that this notion of being of one body extends to all of living nature and isn't restricted solely to the people who happen to be in the community in Corinth in the distant past. And so it's basically a Christian view of inclusion, but it's a widening one. And I also mentioned in the book was the issue that some people have about whether we're demeaned by acknowledging our relationship with other living things. And, I mean, some people just don't like thinking of other plants and animals as being relatives at all. But most people who aren't just emotionally bothered one way or the other by seeing us as one with other animals might be bothered more by the theoretical question of whether they have souls. Are we special in the eyes of the Lord? And if we are special and created in his image, how could a robin or a blue jay also be created in his image? And how does, or another primate, be created in his image? Isn't this solely for us? But that's not the point. We may very well be the only living creatures who are made in the image of God. The way God made us this way, though, was through the material whose signature is present in our in the genes we share in common. And Genesis is very clear that God made us from mud just the way he made everything else from the same mud. It's a material connection that biologists are discerning. It's, if you will, the signature of the mud talked about in Genesis, that mud that connects us with other living things. And it's the dust to which we return when we die. And that doesn't say anything about whether or not God gave our ancestors at some time our souls, and uniquely us, our souls. I don't know whether or not other animals have souls either. I don't want to say for sure that they don't or that some of them don't. But in any case, as you know, even from Roman Catholic teaching, the idea is that God breathes a soul into each and every one of us, and that each and every one of us are special in the eyes of the Lord. And when our ancestors were just emerging from the cave, so to speak, there must have been a time at which they could carry out a moral discussion with one another. And when that happened, then certainly by that time, when people could discuss what the difference between right and wrong was, and between good and evil, and when we were given a free will, then that's when God entrusted us with a soul, and we assumed the status of being human beings. And so the fact that we share a lineage with every other living thing doesn't make us unspecial in the eyes of the Lord at all. It just means that we share material with everything else. That's already present in the Bible. That's already acknowledged.
Well, Professor Roughgarden, I really appreciate your taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us this afternoon. And once again, Joan's book is Evolution and Christian Faith, Reflections of an Evolutionary Biologist, published on Island Press in the year 2006. Once again, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for asking me.
And you can listen to this and other podcasts at the Crosswalk America website at www.crosswalkamerica.org, or also go directly to the Crosswalk America podcast site at crosswalkamerica.podomatic.com. Until we meet again, this has been Eric Elmas with the Crosswalk America podcast.